Welcome to Talk Iran. This is Saman Askeri. Today on the podcast, Neda Maqboule. Author of the 2017 book, Limits of Whiteness, Iranian Americans and the Everyday Politics of Race, Neda Maqboule is an assistant professor in the Department of Sociology at the University of Toronto. Her research focuses on the sociology of race and ethnicity and international migration by examining settlement and discrimination-related challenges facing Middle Eastern and North African migrants in North America. Dr. Maqboule received her Bachelor of Arts at Smith College and her Master's and PhD from University of California, Santa Barbara. She frequently provides commentary to media outlets on issues related to her expertise. She and I talk about her background, race within the Iranian and the Iranian-American context, the Aryan myth as it exists among Iranians, the history of racial classification in the U.S., the importance of racial classification or lack thereof, the definition of whiteness, the research that's currently being done on these subjects, and other topics. So without further ado, let's dive into my conversation with Neda Maqboule. What made you interested in the sociology of race in the first place?
So my own personal biography is that I was born in the United States to my parents who were the original immigrants from Iran. And so that technically, in terms of sociological definitions, makes them the first generation Iranian Americans in my family. And because I was born in the U.S., I am a second generation immigrant or Iranian American. So I was born in New York City. And at a very young age, my parents moved our family to Portland, Oregon. And that's where I grew up my whole life before going to the East Coast for undergraduate. I came back to the West Coast, to California this time for graduate school. And I had been an ugly American who really only saw the world through my American lens until I landed a job up here in Toronto, Canada. And so I moved here about 5 years ago. And that's kind of my bullet points sort of in my personal trajectory. But my interest in the sociology of race, I think, is really shaped by the experience I had growing up in the U.S. I think if you're interested in understanding how society works, and in particular, you're interested in social issues, things like power or inequality or the fight for justice, in the U.S., you have to grapple with the legacy and the present day effect of race and racism. This goes all the way back to the original founding sin of the U.S. as a place of chattel slavery and as a place where land was seized from indigenous people. And so race is baked into the DNA of how this country even came to be. And so I think when you're a young person and you don't know quite what you want to do, are you going to become a social worker, a teacher, an activist? If you're interested in those sorts of issues, you're inextricably going to have to grapple with race if you're being raised as an American.
So growing up myself as an Iranian American, I completely understand that. And you sort of have this experience as an Iranian American that you don't really fit into any one category. And much of your writing centers around that concept, around the racial paradox that Iranian Americans face. We are considered to be white, legally speaking, but are not treated as white or not looked at as white. Can you elaborate on that a little bit?
For sure. That is the central, I think, argument or the contribution of my book is to say that Iranians ourselves, we have these internal myths about our own, whether you want to call it whiteness or the myth Aryayi, whatever it is, right? We bring to our immigrant context our own ideas about a racial hierarchy and a civilization and where we fit in that arrangement. Right. But we also are, you know, integrated into a multiracial nation here in the U.S. that has long been defined by a very strict black-white binary, but particularly after 1965, with the relaxation of immigration laws, we have these really critical, visible masses of groups who assert an Asian identity or a Latino identity, vice versa, even multiracial identity, right, in the past 20 or 30 years. And so you have this case of a group like Iranians who, although they have been in the United States for, you know, several centuries, and I outline some of this history in my book, they really show up in a kind of critical mass way only in the last 40 years. Mm-hmm. And so Iranians who bring with them their own myths of whiteness enter an arena where the politics of this country are really defined, right, in racial terms. They enter at a time when by 1978 and 1979, the federal government for the first time has moved toward creating standard racial categories across every agency and bureau. And so in that critical moment, groups from the Middle East and North Africa become lumped together with Europeans in what the U.S. calls the white racial category. But you also, for Iranians, have this moment of dramatic racialization in politics and media when it comes to the Islamic Revolution of 1979. And so at the same time that Iranians and other groups from that region of the world get lumped together with Europeans in the white racial category in the U.S., they're also experiencing a dramatic uptick in hate crimes and racialization that has to do, right, with the sort of vilification of that region of the world and Islam more broadly.
Yeah.
So that is a paradox that is kind of at the heart of my book. And I think Iranians are an incredible lens to look more broadly, right, about issues like anti-Muslim racism or the racialization of people of a quote-unquote Middle Eastern background, because that moment in 1979 was so dramatic in terms of the way it shaped the racial thinking, I think, of Americans more broadly about people from that part of the world.
So let's talk about the myths that you mentioned. Growing up, for example, I was told that Iranians are Aryans. Iran means the land of the Aryans. And you've brought up the concept of the Aryan myth in your book, Limits of Whiteness, that you published last year. What does the Aryan myth say anyway? And what's the accurate outlook that Iranians should have about their background?
Yeah. So, you know, this first became important in the scope of my project because the bulk of the ethnographic work I was doing, so like hanging out, interviewing, observing everyday Iranian American life, was with young people, was with second generation kids. And although grandparents and parents, first generation, seeped their way into my book, and I ended up including many of their experiences and their voices, this really started as a project about second generation kids. And so fundamentally, this was, you know, this repeated pattern over and over where young people would tell me, right, like, I was bullied in school because of the way I look or because of my name, XYZ reasons. And when I went home and I shared this with my family, my family's response was, you know, you should just march back to school and tell them you're the original white people of the world. You're Aryayi, you're Aryan, you know. And so for the young people, when they shared these sorts of narratives, they would say, you know, like, that doesn't make sense. In the United States, when we say Aryan, that means neo-Nazi.
Right.
How am I going to go back to school and tell people, oh, no, like, I'm an Aryan? They would say this language, these myths, they don't make sense in diaspora. It's not legible to other people. And so on top of this sort of language about being, quote unquote, an original white person or having some sort of, you know, historical connection to the concept of Aryan versus Semite, also other layers of this myth that were sort of mutually constitutive had to do with, you know, we're Caucasian, the Caucasus Mountains in Central Asia, right, and sort of a sort of geographical sense of raciality, the ways that people would borrow from the sort of debunked science of ethnology, the idea that language, right, has a kind of racial family tree. And so they would often say things like, we speak Persian, not Arabic. Persian is on the Indo-European language tree. And so actually we have these connections to Europeans, and that's borne out through our language, and that we were able to keep our language separate from Arabic. Props to Ferdowsi. Do you know what I mean? Like,
yes,
there's
yes.
just all of these different layers that sort of support this idea, right, of a kind of racial exceptionalism.
Sure.
And a concept that I draw on in my book comes from the historian Reza Zia Ebrahimi, whose book came out last year with Columbia University Press, which is about the sort of dislocation of Iran in the national narratives that are that are sort of part of Iran's own history and their own myths. And so he's looking at the scholarship that was produced in a moment of a sort of crescendo of nationalist sentiment when, as part of a kind of state project, right, intellectual scholars, people who study literature, they were looking back into ancient civilization to try to make these sorts of connections to Europe, to say, like, okay, a term like Arya, which may have had an ethnic connotation, actually, right, has a sort of racial locus in a connection to Europe. And so these sorts of issues, I drew a lot on the scholarship of a new generation of historians who have uncovered, right, the kind of origin of those myths in Iran. And my book really takes up what happens when these myths move around the world because of the migration of Iranians as immigrants to other parts of the world.
One of the reasons that a lot of Iranians talk about being Aryan goes back to the time before World War II, or right around World War II, where Iran was sort of aligning itself with Nazi Germany. Does that have anything to do with why we think we are Aryan? Or is there a more historical reason when you go back and you look at migrations of various peoples across the across where Iran lies right now, the greater Iran? Where does the concept of Aryan come from?
Parts of chapter 2 and chapter 3, I really delve into this sort of from the perspective of like an Iranian American, right? Somebody that was born in the US, it's a bit like toxic, right? To find out about the way that some of these myths around the time of World War II, right, were a kind of political project to bring Iran closer to Germany. And this had to do with like different axes of power. And so the idea that this word Aryai or Aryan, you know, was used strategically to draw connections in Nazi Germany, I think can be really shocking for people, but that's absolutely part of the historical case. So it's cool that you had heard of that, because I would say that the majority of people who come to my book, and even myself, right, in the process of researching my book, like that was surprising and quite disturbing. But this has been a project that's been, you know, centuries in the making. And so even before this World War II era that we're talking about right now, this was really, it dovetailed with Iranian nationalism from 100 years even before that, right? This recuperation of a kind of Iranian myth, this idea of an exceptional Iranian person who's not a Turk, they're not an Arab, right? And in fact, you know, this has been something that is a really selective, like you're suggesting, a selective reading of who has lived within the borders of Iran, as if the Iran we recognize today, right, sort of was some sort of meaningful border at the time. No, like there has been this traffic even in our own family histories, right, of like multiple ethnicities, multiple groups that now are tied to different nation states in the broader Middle East. And so, yeah, this has been a fiction in my book, really. Is one of the few books so far at this stage to sort of say, right, to not understand present day Iranian American lives in terms of this bigger history of racial baggage that we have as a community is really, it's too much of a narrow focus to not think about those things too.
How should Iranians think about their race if they're asked, you know, what is your race? What should they say?
Yeah, it's very interesting to me because my own feelings about this have changed over time. So as I was conducting the research for this project, so like hanging out with young people, learning their stories, visiting their families, I had a very strong sense that like these families, these young people, they're being racialized as non-white. The way the experiences that they keep having, they're accruing them in the workplace or in school, all signs point to you're not white. And so like get a grip and, you know, whatever kind of identity we need to be organizing around, we need to understand that the world simply isn't sort of treating us as any other white group. And right, all the time, the kind of main referent that young people would use would, they'd be like, I'm not white like an Italian person, as much as my family thinks we are or wants to believe we are. We're not just any old Italians. We're not the Irish, right? And it's interesting because those are the groups that historically in the United States had sort of been considered non-white at some point, and then they ended up moving into whiteness for a variety of different reasons that have to do with power and socioeconomics and racial exclusion. So it was sort of through their acts of anti-blackness that the Irish and the Italian were able to prove, for example, that they were white. And so over time, I began to think of this as like almost the opposite case when it comes to Iranians and other groups from the broad Middle East. Since their arrival as a critical mass 40 years ago, this is a group that has technically been considered white by the federal government, but they're sort of moving out of white into, I think, some other sort of category, whether it's MENA, Middle Eastern, North African. SWANA is another acronym people use, which stands for Southwest Asia and North Africa, or if we're using the Orientalist category, Middle East, right? That I felt like, okay, we might in some ways be the opposite case to these white ethnic groups like the Italian and the Irish. I think what surprised me in the course of my research was that the world has begun changing dramatically. The Census Bureau, after about 30 or 40 years of direct agitation by Arab American and Iranian American advocacy groups, finally in 2015 did its first internal test where they gave versions of a potential 2020 census to members of these different communities that we think of as Middle Eastern. And they basically were able to test if you give someone a MENA category, standing for Middle East, North African, and they're Iranian or they're Moroccan or they're Chaldean, whatever it is, will they go for that box if they're offered that as an option, or will they go for white? And overwhelmingly, for every single one of the 20-plus subgroups that they tested the census for, every group, a majority of the people in that group, went for MENA and not white. And so even though my research, I was like, Iranians should wake up and they should think of themselves that way, I was like, damn, by 2015, we actually have quantitative evidence that when you give Iranians the choice, they do go for that. So something has happened, right? Whether it's 9/11, whether it's by 2015, right? We didn't have Trump or the travel ban yet, but whether it was NSEERS and the different kinds of Obama era projects we have around the war on terror, right? There has been something that has shifted the needle. And when I was doing my project, oftentimes sociologists or other people, right, like people sort of very educated in this specific niche area, they would say to me, I don't ever believe that an Iranian or a Lebanese person would occupy, they would put themselves in the same category as a Yemeni or as an Iraqi or as a this or as a that Egyptian, right? That these groups have too many internal hierarchies, differences around language, ethnicity, religion, they'll never see themselves as belonging to a similar group. And yet, by the 2015 internal test of the Census Bureau, all of those different groups were, right, the Lebanese and the Iranians were supposed to hold themselves over to the side as like the white ones, all of these groups, right, they saw a kind of common sense of identity and they went for that category. So this was, of course, like very explosive, potentially. The census, after having done these tests, made the recommendation to the office of the White House to say, we should move forward by 2020 and to offer MENA as a category that is separate from white and as its own ethno-racial identity. The Obama administration seemed like they were behind that recommendation. And then, of course, as we know, once Trump was elected, every single bureau and agency in Washington, D.C. was in a state of chaos. Right. And so the long story short there, right, is that the director of the Census Bureau resigned. The Trump administration said they weren't going to move forward with any of the recommendations to change the different racial and ethnic categories, because also Latino was supposed to be revised and there were all these different recommendations. They said they're not going to move forward with that, but they will introduce a citizenship question, right? And so the ground was poised to shift in one way to create more recognition. We could have a more accurate count of Iranians, but now we're risking having an even worse count than we already have. Whereas, you know, Iranians have always been lost in the white category and it's hard to have an accurate count. Now there's this new, you know, citizen question potentially that's going to be included in the 2020 census, which is supposed to really depress the sort of response rate among groups like Iranians who will feel that, you know, the government is surveilling them and that they don't want to participate in the census.
So you just talked about the changing definition of whiteness over history because of various reasons, political reasons. Is there a universally accepted definition of what being white means? Obviously, it's, you know, it depends on the context, what country you're in, the political environment. But it, I mean, scientifically speaking, is there such a thing as the white race?
Yeah, that's a great question. So at this point, we are kind of getting into that debate or that question that still in 2018 is so salient in science, which is, you know, is race solely a social construct, the way social scientists have been saying, you know, for a generation, or is there some sort of biological construct that is somehow meaningful or legible? And so, you know, the latest cutting edge research that's about human genomics proves that racial categories, so what we think of as white or what we think of as black, Asian, Latino, Middle Eastern, these are really weak proxies for the full range of genetic diversity. They're suggesting that racial categories are not useful in terms of health research or different sorts of scientific, you know, inquiries into genetics. They have conclusively shown that there is far more genetic similarity across individuals from different racial groups, so that a white person, quote unquote white person, could share more genetic similarity and material with a black person than with another white person that they're lumped into that racial group with. And so for these sorts of reasons, even the most hardcore, if we're thinking of science as like the people who wear white lab coats and who work in laboratories with clipboards, you know, even among, you know, scientists doing really mainstream research, there's been a real debunking of a biological basis for race. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, we know, right, that the effects of racism and the kind of cognitive work that we do as individuals and as groups to create an us versus them, or a sort of lumping and sorting based on a sense of racial difference, has huge effects that are borne out psychologically. They have health effects on people's well-being, that these ideas of racial difference have, you know, a dramatic effect of creating unequal access to material resources, like having a safe and stable home, your income, your wealth, your education, you know, any number of what we would call these inputs into life chances. And so for sure, you know, whether it's social science or natural science right now, there's a common understanding that although race is not biologically real, it has very, very real social consequences in the way societies organize themselves. And so for me, I think this is so fascinating, and it absolutely directly helps me make sense of the case of Iranians, where, you know, on many measures, like when you're looking at a kind of straightforward theory of assimilation, this is like the bread and butter of sociology in the United States, this idea that immigrants come, and if they are able to, you know, have educational attainment and they're spatially integrated with other white people, that means they're on a kind of upward trajectory, and if they're not already white, they'll be becoming white or considered part of the mainstream. And we see that although on many sort of socioeconomic criteria, Iranian Americans seem like they're on par with or even performing better than quote unquote white Americans. Nonetheless, right, there's differential access to resources like healthcare. There are different sorts of mental health issues that our community faces at a kind of dramatic, sort of a proportion that people who are part of that European American white majority aren't facing. And so the issue of these perceptions of racial difference, I think, are really, really important when we're looking at a group like Iranians.
When you look across different populations, the mean of various traits would be different, right? I mean, especially for health reasons, for example, like when you go to the doctor, certain groups of people are more prone to be, I don't know, have certain kind of predispositions to certain genetic diseases or whatever it may be. But you just mentioned that that's not really a concern, right?
So this is a really critical moment in terms of the kind of innovations that we're creating in medicine when it comes to unlocking the potential of the human genome. Because for a very long time, there was an understanding that certain illnesses have a genetic predisposition that maps onto race. And so, for example, the idea of cystic fibrosis as a illness that affects, as a disease that affects white populations, European origin populations, has actually had the effect of dramatically undercounting the number of, for example, African Americans who in fact are suffering from cystic fibrosis. But because there's this idea that this is a white disease and black diseases for some, you know, in some places have been sort of understood as like heart disease or diabetes or this or that, you know, that in fact, there's almost like a kind of channeling effect that you see where there's an underdiagnosis of the actual prevalence of certain diseases among some populations because it's considered rare in their groups. But actually, every study that's coming out and really, really, you know, sort of like extremely mainstream accepted journals, places like Science, is showing, right, that these are actually really, they've been highly flawed, the way that we've thought of certain diseases as being, you know, more prevalent or indigenous in some ways to certain geographic or racial populations.
Yeah. In your research and in your work, have you looked into how Iranians inside Iran look at race? So if you go to Iran and ask people what your race is, what do they usually say?
You know, something really interesting has been that while in my book, I limited my scope to working with people who are Iranian American, I'm fundamentally centering material from the case of the United States. Of course, right, these sorts of myths and the kinds of self-understandings that Iranians have back home in Iran, of course, influence what I'm noticing here. Something interesting to me was since my book was released, there's been a lot of interest from Iranians within Iran to have it translated into Persian so that it's able to be read more widely by people in Iran, because according to these folks that have reached out to me, you know, this is something that is still a taboo. And I'm like, it's a taboo here in the U.S. too. We typically do not talk about these things. Although, again, I believe that this is really changing very, very quickly, particularly, right, with something like the travel ban, this really direct kind of essentialized racial idea of Iranians as somehow the other as a group to exclude from the American polity, I think has made Iranian Americans more apt to talk about race. But at the same time, I think there's also a lot of impetus and interest from within Iran to begin having more public conversations about this sort of thing. And so although I'm not close to the ground and I'm not able to give you a kind of insight about exactly what people are talking about and who's talking about it, my own sense of like the feedback I'm getting from people within Iran is that, you know, this is something that they also are talking about and they want to be communicating about it much more.
Mm-hmm. So when we look into the future, is there a right way to classify people? Is there a usefulness to these sorts of classifications of race?
So I think that, you know, it's a real predicament because we know that by believing in race, we have the effect of making it real. Yeah. But I think fundamentally in these sorts of societies and the way that they're organized, to actually be lost in the margin and to not have a kind of legible racial identity that is clear and coherent and makes sense puts groups like Iranians at a significant disadvantage. And so I think ultimately it's better for them to be part of a category separate from white, whether it's MENA or whatever they want to call it, because the way that amelioration or redress for discrimination or hate crimes or these different sorts of inequities is actually, you know, sort of remunerated through the law in the United States is through court, is through the language of civil rights. And the strongest arm of civil rights historically has been through race-based claims. And so when Iranians are unable to make race-based claims that harms have been committed against them, it's extremely hard to go to court and be able to say, well, I think this person discriminated against me because they perceived that I'm Muslim, but I'm actually secular, right? But I think that this was Islamophobia that happened to me. Or to say, you know, this is an ethnic matter, or it's something having to do with my national origin as Iranian. Fundamentally, the most sort of strong appeal to justice in the U.S. has been through the idea of racial solidarity across different communities who have been racialized as communities of color. And so you get this sort of worst of all scenarios, I think, for people from the Middle East right now, where when the FBI or the police wants to identify you, whether or not you check white on the boxes of the census, they have mechanisms to find out where you live. They can even get as close to your zip code, your street address, right? And it's through a variety of means, like profiling last names, et cetera, right? So we're able to be recognized when it comes to policing and surveillance and you know, sort of these sorts of issues that have to do with national security. And yet when it comes to legibility in terms of having ample access to healthcare, resources, affirmative action, different sorts of entitlements that groups from the Middle East are absolutely, I believe, entitled to when it's appropriate, suddenly, who are the Middle Easterners? We can't find them. They're not part of a protected racial class, right? And so it's sort of like getting the worst of both worlds. And when people ask me, right, like, don't we just want to kind of be lumped in as white or to have no racial categories at all? And isn't this a better thing for our community? I think, you know, it's very clear that when the federal government or even local law enforcement wants to enforce these distinctions, right, about what makes Iranians different than the kind of average citizen or ordinary American, they have no problem doing so. And so in that sense, then I think that we need to mobilize around getting the kinds of minority protections that other groups have.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So your work is super fascinating. What are your future plans in terms of any other work or books or research? Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. Yeah. Well, something I'm excited by is, you know, although this book has come out and to some extent, like my work on Iranian Americans has been mostly published, like I still have a couple articles that are coming out and I'm continuing to talk to a lot of folks in our community. And there's just like so much really exciting new work that's coming out about Iranians in the United States. And so I just want a sort of flag for people that are interested in this to say, like, my book is one small contribution, but there's so much more stuff coming out in the next 12 months even. So there's a book that's coming out about international students from Iran in the 1960s and the kinds of, you know, anti-war activism that they took part of in places like UC Berkeley. That's a monograph coming out with Duke University Press by my colleague Manija Nasrabadi, who's an assistant professor of women and gender studies at Barnard. The work of anthropologist Amy Malek at the College of Charleston has to do with a kind of comparative look at immigrants from Iran in the U.S., Canada, and Sweden, right? So there's this new work that's looking at a broader global diaspora of Iranians. There's Sahar Sadeghi at Muhlenberg College, who will have a book coming out that's about comparing U.S. immigrants, Iranian immigrants in the U.S. to those in Germany. And so there's just like this huge, I think, wave of really creative new work that's coming out. All of these people that I just mentioned are going to be part of a conference in March that's San Francisco State coming up. And so if your listeners are interested, it's a beautiful conference put on by the Iranian Diaspora Studies Center, directed by Persis Karim at SF State. And so
that's in my backyard. I'm in San Jose.
Yeah, myself, Hamid Nafisi, you know, Dr. Nafisi, who's just the person, really, he and Persis Karim are two of the founders, really, of Iranian diaspora studies. They're all going to be part of this event. And so it's happening Thursday, March 28th through Saturday, March 30 in 2019. And so if people are interested in moving these conversations forward, we're all going to be there. And it's super cool conference. It's like artists, musicians, scholars, community activists, lawyers, everybody's coming together. And then more broadly in my own research, because I live in Canada now and I'm inspired by the environment around me, you know, at the same time that the Obama era was over and Trump was elected, we had regime change in Canada, where the previous prime minister, who was a conservative guy named Stephen Harper, his term was over, and Justin Trudeau, who represents the liberal government, he was elected. And so it was a different kind of a regime change here when I moved to Canada. And so we have the large-scale resettlement of Syrian refugees in Canada, which has been a really incredible moment of social transformation to be a part of. And so I have a new project that looks at the kinds of integration and discrimination-related challenges faced by this community of new refugees in the Toronto area. And so I have a new project with Syrian refugee moms and teenagers and a big research team full of Arabic speakers, which is really exciting to, I think, be able to take some of the lessons I've learned about Iranians in the United States and to apply it to a case that in some ways has some overlap and in some ways is really different. And so it's helping me think about, you know, the U.S. versus Canada, refugees versus immigrants, Arabs versus Iranians, any number of different things. I think there's interesting overlaps and comparisons to be made. And so that's a project that I'm super busy with right now because I got about $500,000 of money from the Canadian government. And so it's a pretty massive project, but I'm super excited to be doing it.
Exciting. Yeah.
Thanks.
The March conference sounds amazing as well. I'm going to look into it.
Okay, good.
Yeah. So where can people follow your work? I know you're somewhat active on social media. Is that correct?
Yeah. So I post like a lot about the stuff that I'm reading and the communities of scholars that I'm a part of on Twitter. And so my handle is Neda Soch, N-E-D-A-S-O-C. So people can always find me there. And again, if you're interested in these sorts of topics, I post about this type of stuff a lot. Also, I have a website. If you just Google my name, you can find my contact info and kind of a bigger picture of what I'm up to.
Fantastic. All right, Neda, you were very generous with your time. Really appreciate it. A really fascinating discussion. And I hope we continue this at some point.
Thank you so much, Sam and John. I hope we see each other in San Francisco.
All right. Thanks for listening. I hope you found that episode to be interesting and productive. Again, if you did, I would really appreciate it if you shared it on social media or told your friends and family about it. Stay tuned for a lot more great guests coming up. And thanks and take care.